Hey, scientists, how critical is pure water to you? In this new podcast, Lab Water Stories Unfiltered, we at Millipore Sigma look closer at this often overlooked lab essential. Tune in as experts drop tips and insights not found in textbooks, taken from their work with MilliQ Lab Water Solutions. Lab Water Stories Unfiltered. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Millipore Sigma is the U.S. and Canada life science business of Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a community of people seeking to live our lives in the orienting center of God's love in the midst of our post-Christian world, learning to lead like Jesus, live on mission, and make disciples. In nature, gravity is the phenomenon that brings stuff together, objects as small as atoms and quarks, and as large as stars and galaxies. We believe the gravity of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ. The Gravity Leadership Podcast is curated conversations on what it looks like to practically orient our lives and our leadership in the love of Christ, the gravity that holds everything together.
Hey, friends, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Really glad that you have pressed play on this episode. We're looking forward to this interview that we had with Steve Cuss, who has some brilliant insights to bring about family systems theory into the world of Christian leadership. He's a pastor who also does some of this leadership stuff as well. So he's a lot like us, a lot like the folks who started Gravity Leadership. So he's a kindred spirit, and we're looking forward to that, being able to give you that interview. I'm doing the intro here all by myself. My compatriots are otherwise occupied in various pursuits. So it's up to me to deliver the news, the announcements to y'all. So I want to give you those things before we get started with this interview. Friends, there's a lot, you may not be aware of this, but there are a lot of other ways besides listening to this podcast that you can connect with us. There are a growing number of people who are connecting with us and connecting with each other, who are learning to lead like Jesus and live on mission and make disciples. And so it's really exciting. I want to tell you about some of these things. We do workshops. One of the kinds of workshops we do is Enneagram Transformation Workshops. It's typically a Friday night and a Saturday where we come in and we do some training around this tool called the Enneagram. We're probably going to do some podcasting about it here in the near future because it's gotten so popular. It's also gotten some some backlash, and there's some people that can tend to look at it a little sideways because of it's been overused and misused. But we found it to be a really powerful tool for spiritual formation, and it coheres quite nicely with a lot of our process for leadership development, training, coaching, discipleship, etc. So we've got a number of those coming up that if you're in the area, you can join us at. So we're going to be in the Atlanta area October 18th and 19th. We're going to be in Philadelphia November 1st and 2nd. We're going to be in Lexington, Kentucky, November 15th and 16th. And in the new year, in 2020, we're going to be in Indianapolis and Kalamazoo. And I just literally got off the phone 3 minutes ago with another person that we're beginning to talk with to bring another Enneagram workshop. So I'd love it if you guys could find your way to one of those. Or even better, if you want to bring an Enneagram Transformation Workshop or any of our other workshops, we do a workshop about what it means to be the church in the post-Christendom. So that's called Church in the Wild. And we also do a workshop on parenting, actually, and how to bring the insights of discipleship into parenting, how to treat your parenting as a discipleship exercise. That one's called Parenting in Grace and Truth. If you're interested in bringing any of those to your church, to your area, do check out the show notes, click on the appropriate link, or just email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. We're starting to book those events for 2020 and would love for you to get on our schedule. A couple other things. If you haven't gone through our free audio course called 7 Vital Paradigm Shifts for Leading Like Jesus, It's essentially the first few episodes of this podcast. So, I mean, one way you could do it is scroll down to the first few episodes of this podcast and listen to them. We talk through our seven axioms for leading like Jesus, missional living. They really function as a completely new paradigm for what ministry can look like, what life really can look like. And we talk through those, the first few episodes of this podcast, but we've also kind of collected them into a format where you can get every few days, you get a new one delivered to your email inbox and that kind of a thing. So if you haven't listened to those and you're interested in that, there's a link in the show notes. Just go to gravityleadership.com/shifts. It's hard to say. gravityleadership.com/shifts to get that free audio course. And of course, another new thing that is just fresh in the last month or so is our membership community on Patreon. People for a long time have been asking us, hey, you know, coaching isn't, it's not the right season for me to get into your training, for it to get into your coaching, but is there any other way that I can support and partner with the work that you guys are doing? And so finally, we pulled the trigger on experimenting with a membership community on Patreon. It's at patreon.com/gravityleadership. And essentially, you can sign up there to support and partner with us in our work. There's three different tiers you can sign up for: $5 a month, $15 a month, or $30 a month. And there's different things that you get, you know, little perks that we put in each of those. But really, most of the people who are doing this just because they want to support the work that we're doing. They want to partner with us in it. They want kind of a stake in the game, and are really happy to have those folks. As of this recording, some new folks who've joined us are Rich and Heather Cordero, new supporters on Patreon. Thank you so much for joining us there. If you're interested, again, just check it out at patreon.com/gravityleadership, and that'll show you all you need to know there. We'd love to have you there. If you have any questions, just email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. I think that's it, folks, for now. We're going to hear from Steve Cuss here on managing leadership anxiety. Here we go.
Okay, hey, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. We are recording today live from the suburbs of Indianapolis, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Although when you're listening, this won't be live. But no, but rest assured, we are live now. This is happening in real time.
Yeah, we're recording it live.
And we are joined today by a gentleman and a scholar and a pastor and a chaplain and a husband and a dad. Steve.
And a dog lover. Yep.
And a dog lover. Okay, we need to talk about this.
We need to talk about dogs.
Speaking of anxiety and leadership, I need your help. Steve Cuss joins us all the way from Colorado. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you. And I'm very relieved to hear that we're recording live, because recording other ways gets really problematic.
Yeah, yeah.
We've tried it
recording
both ways.
In the future, all of that, it doesn't
tape
really
delayed.
Work.
Yeah. Steve, will
you... It just gets expensive, too.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, and we're doing this on a shoestring budget.
That's right.
Steve, you've written a book that, I mean, is coming from the center or the heart of what we do at Gravity Leadership, called Managing Leadership Anxiety. And it takes family systems theory and chaos, like change theory.
Neurobiology.
I thought you were going to say chaotic ideas. Yes.
It takes all these. It's a theology of anxiety. It's a brilliant book. Before we jump into it, though, would you give our listeners a brief introduction, who you are, how you spend your time?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yep. Thanks for having me on the show. So I'm a West Australian by species. Grew up in Perth and grew up completely unchurched. And I came to faith as a teenager. And I was in university when I really felt the call to ministry. So I came to the United States to study because I had no theology at all. And in the course of that, I stumbled accidentally into hospital chaplaincy. And it really was, from at least my point of view, quite an accident. I just needed a job for a year my wife and I, well, my fiance and I had just gotten married and I needed work for a year. And a lot of the book is based on my lessons that at least started in hospital chaplaincy. And then after that, I went to seminary. I kind of did things in the wrong order. And in seminary, I dived as deep as I could into systems theory and another really fascinating theory called cybernetics that I actually haven't seen written about in church leadership. I didn't realize that I was bringing something unique when I wrote the book. But since the book's come out, I've been engaging with a ton of systems theorists, which has been super fun. Mm. And none of them have heard of cybernetics.
Weird.
Yeah, it really blew me away. So that was, and that was a game changer. Yeah. And then I'm now a local church pastor, and I've been using these materials for 20 odd years, and then wrote about it, released it a few months ago.
Yeah, and tell us about your church. What is it? A medium sized, small church, big church?
I don't know how to describe our church. So we are white suburban, middle upper class for sure on the surface, and then I think when you peel back the veneer, we are into studying and trying to break the patterns of chronic poverty locally and globally. Hmm. I think because I'm an Aussie, even just politically, we're much different. People have come and said we're the most politically diverse church they've ever seen. Mm. So we have people who have actually told me that they're to the right of Rush Limbaugh, which is impressive. That's exhausting.
Exhausting and impressive, yes.
And then I also have people who would go on every possible march they could, so we have a spectrum of people. And then because I grew up unchurched, we have quite a outreach to intellectual skeptics. That would be our bread and butter. And so we're kind of a combination of reaching intellectual skeptics and then social activism.
Yeah,
and we get about 1,000 people a week. In the summer, we get about 700 a week. Mm-hmm. But and then 5 years ago, we were about 250 people. So we've gone on this insane growth,
that's
mostly really because we moved into a building. We were a portable church. And I don't know. I mean, it's been really fun and it's been really difficult. So I don't know if I recommend rapid growth. I'm glad that rapid part is settled because we're still catching up. I think we're still catching up.
Yeah. So you don't recommend church growth? No.
That's the quote. Yeah, I hate church growth. Yeah.
Great. Yeah, well, it's been good having you on the podcast, Steve.
Yeah.
It's great.
I'm very helpful.
So your book is it's a great read. In fact, we have a 3-year coaching and training process we put leaders through, and the third year is all about leadership. And your book's going to become a resource in that because I think you do a great job of taking what is a deep, deep rabbit hole of family systems theory.
Yes.
And condensing it without making it too simplistic to be helpful. It was really good. But let me ask you this just to kick us off. How did you become an expert about anxiety?
Oh, yeah. I think it's personal survival for sure.
Like trying to make sense of your life and the things that impede and hinder your life.
It definitely started for me in the intensive care units in the emergency room in this hospital. There's no question. I was 24 years of age, and I'm just by personality and wiring, I'm an Enneagram 3 with a 4 wing. Mm. I'm a type A, highly driven, entrepreneurial, arrogant, certain leader. So I'm very aggressive, and I truly thank God for that chaplaincy experience because it didn't remove all of that from me, but it showed me the impact of it. And it's certainly when you are a get-it-done, solution-focused leader, grief is the one thing that'll teach you how useless that is.
Oh, yeah.
So I definitely started learning those lessons, walking into rooms of high anxiety. And what they do in that program that I was in, a CPE, is they teach you how to notice your own reactivity.
Yep.
So
can you unpack that? What does that mean?
So when you walk into a room and somebody is screaming and someone else is headbutting a wall with grief, and your next instinct is to do something, it's more to manage your own anxiety than to actually help them.
So you walk in the room, people are freaking out, there's uncontrollable emotion, and you have this impulse to solve it, fix it, do something.
Yep.
And what you're saying is reactivity is this dynamic where you want your impulse to act has more to do with you than it has to do with them.
Yeah, not always. I'm always careful to not have blanket statements, but in that case, in that situation, always, yes. because somebody, and we, now that we have some life experience under our belt, somebody who has suffered a grief or a death, the last thing they need is words or what happens is the leader tries to shrink the situation down to something they can manage.
Yeah.
That That's why often a leader will say a prayer or quote a scripture, and it just doesn't land. And I'm not saying that you should never pray and you should never quote scripture.
Sure.
All I'm saying is before you reach for that impulse, you can take a beat and ask yourself, is this to make me feel better or is this actually to serve the person?
Good. Yeah, that's really helpful. So managing that, that's what you mean by managing your own reactivity. Is instead of just trusting that impulse, I got to do something, you notice it and you're able to kind of look at it at least and measure it a little bit and say, well, why would I do this? Why would I step in to do this?
Yeah. And then, and then the deeper level is, what's driving me? So, you know, when I first started walking into these rooms, I didn't know at the time that I'm being driven by a need to look impressive. And my need to look impressive for me would be connected to the fact that as a kid and as a teenager, I always felt stupid. I just had decided that I'm the stupid kid. And so anytime I don't know what to do in front of people, I feel exposed. That makes me anxious. And then I act. Now, all those moves took several months and a lot of thought, but any leader or, you know, any faith leader can just begin to start to figure out, and this would be interesting to hear from you guys, like in any given situation, what is it that I think I need that I don't actually need?
Yes.
Right.
It'd be interesting to hear from what you guys think, you know, if you can identify something.
Oh,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, you said you're a dog lover.
Yeah.
I just got a new dog. And a new puppy, and we actually had been resisting it for months, but like almost years. With our, we have a 10 and a 7-year-old, and they really wanted a dog, and
it didn't help that we got a dog 2 years ago.
Thanks a lot, babe.
Yeah.
And so we finally, my wife and I finally broke down and got this dog, and I had a few conditions, and most of those conditions had to do with me being as bothered as little by this dog as possible. But my 10-year-old, who's taking most responsibility for the dog, is at camp this week. He's away at a week at camp. And so I get up early in the morning, and I'm noticing, Steve, that I love my autonomy in the morning.
That's good.
I love it. And this dog compromises every single bit of my autonomy. I got to let her right out of the cage. She's 9 weeks old. She goes outside. She poops. I'm sitting on the back patio. I don't like, some people wake up out of bed and they're like working through their to-do list. Like they've made the bed, started laundry, started coffee in like the first 10 minutes of getting up. I like go and sit on a couch and I need like 90 minutes of just like, who am I again? What's my life about? My brain takes so long to wake up. Well, this dog is like, this morning even, I was pooping. Which is great. Dogs poop, and then when they poop outside, that's what they're supposed to do.
Right.
Nope. So far, so good. But there's dew all over the grass, and my dog poops, and then she begins to eat it. So now I'm taking off my socks, and I'm sprinting across the backyard to go grab this dog who's eating her poop, and I pull her back up on the patio, and I go try to grab a bag to go clean the poop up, but she begins to chew on my socks with her, you know, poop teeth. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm like prying poop socks out of her mouth. I put her in timeout in the bathroom. She chews through the toilet paper. You know, she's biting my leg. She's eating the wood. And it's like not even 6 a.m. yet. And I'm like completely stressed out of my mind.
Yeah.
And it's mostly because I have decided that my happiness, my joy, my peace, my contentment, the good life, this dog interferes with everything I've told myself I need for that.
Yeah, you need autonomy, and because you're not getting it, it's causing this anxiety, this stress.
Look,
yeah.
I got a lot of responsibilities, Ben.
Right? I'm a very important person.
No, just as a dad and a husband and a pastor, right, Steve? Can I get a witness?
Yeah.
And I have to do what other people want all day.
Yeah.
But this time, this precious time, this little time that fits on my ring finger, and I put it on and take it off whenever I want.
Yeah.
Like this time is mine.
Yeah.
And you, dog, are taking my time.
Yeah.
So I don't know, Steve, is that what you're talking about? That's that kind of relationship to something that creates anxiety, anger, stress?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the example, because as I'm listening to it, you know, there's nothing wrong with needing autonomy and some solitude, but it's the, what happens is anxiety makes us a bit more rigid than we really are.
Yes.
Huh. And it's that kind of have to have it to be okay piece of it that makes it where it has a grip on you. So like the need for solitude Also, the other thing that came to mind, Matt, is, you know, when Paul said we're a slave to all, in your mind, you're like, yeah, but not a dog. Nope. Like, I'll be a slave to humans, but I'm not going to be a slave to a stupid canine.
Right.
I get that.
Yeah. I mean, Paul said, watch out for the dogs. You know, and I'm trying to keep mutilating away from that.
This one's trying to get me.
Well, this dog is mutilating my flesh. She keeps biting me. She keeps biting.
This is in the Bible.
That's good. That's really good.
Yeah.
I think it is interesting. We can all start looking at what is it that I need. It's okay to need it, but when I have to have it to be okay, it now has a grip on me instead of me having a grip on it. Because in reality, I can't speak for you, Matt, but you'll probably do okay 4 days a week with autonomy. Mm-hmm. But we do start to believe these lies, and anxiety is definitely generated by what we think we must have in any situation. So for me, the need to always have the answer, the need to have the final word or to always be right. Yeah. These are terrible needs. And then what gets really interesting where anxiety gets chronic is what you do after that when you don't get what you need. So in my case, if I'm misunderstood, my solution is to talk more, because I believe the lie that more words from me will help them understand, and then you get really anxious.
Steve, do you, when that happens, do you ever point to your mouth just so people understand that there's important things happening there? Sometimes I do that as a joke with Ben. I'll just point to my mouth when I'm feeling reactive and triggered. It's a way to sort
listen,
of
listen to me,
diffuse the situation. Anyway,
yeah. No, that's that. I love what you're talking about, Steve, because that it very much is the way that we train leaders, is to begin to notice those things. And so, I mean, you asked for examples, and there's another one for me that I've just recently become, I think, a little bit more aware of. You mentioned being an Enneagram 3. We talk about the Enneagram a lot on this podcast, so if that alienates you, I apologize. But I'm an Enneagram 1.
Send your messages to Steve at
gravityleadership.com. There we go. So I'm an Enneagram 1, and one of the things I've been noticing is that the cause of anxiety for me is when someone says something that is sort of a little bit, I'm trying to think of an example. If somebody says something that kind of comes out of their flesh, if somebody says something that comes from a bad place, I've noticed that part of my anxiety is like, I feel like it's my responsibility to let them know that that's not right.
Yeah.
Right. There was a couple instances that happened to me recently where I realized somebody, I never said anything. I noticed I was feeling anxious when somebody said something to me like this. I never said anything, but a few days later, they said something that indicated to me that they actually knew that it wasn't right. They actually knew that, and they were aware of it. And there was this like a freedom that came over me where I was like, oh, like maybe that's not my job in most situations. Maybe people can figure things out on their own. But I started noticing that that's actually a cause of anxiety for me, is if I hear somebody verbalize something that's like, oh shoot, like that's going to lead you down a bad path, or that's not going to be a good way for you to go. I feel this impulse to act, to speak, to correct, you know, like, let me get you on the right path here.
Oh, that's an amazing example, Ben. Like, what it makes me think of is Jesus in Luke 24 with the road to Emmaus with Cleopas and his companion. A lot of systems theorists, even non-faith-based systems theorists, would point to Jesus as the most differentiated human ever.
Yep. Yeah.
And differentiation is a family systems term. But for our listeners, all differentiation is the ability to be non-anxious in the face of anxiety, to the ability and the capacity to not let someone else's anxiety infect yours and not let yours infect theirs. That would be it.
That's good.
In a nutshell.
So for instance, if somebody says, I have the power to kill you or set you free, you just say, you don't really have any power. That would be like a non-anxious response.
Yeah. The most obvious example in the Bible is Matthew says, Herod was troubled and all Jerusalem was troubled with him. And of course they are, because their well-being is wrapped up in his whim. But that's a non-differentiation. But Jesus is walking along with Cleopas. And what's fascinating to me is they're anxious, and he is what they're anxious about. And if I was him, I would have a tendency to do what I think I heard you say, Ben, which is to relieve them of their anxiety.
Yes.
I would be like, hey, guys, it's Jesus. I'm here.
Yeah, it's fine.
His ability to let them remain anxious for probably hours, they, in my opinion, they had a deeper spiritual experience by him not shortcutting their anxiety than him rushing in to relieve it. And I do think a lot of leaders, we feel this compulsion that our helpfulness is sometimes shortcutting what God has for somebody.
Say more about that, Steve, because I can hear an objection in some people's minds to say, like, isn't that being helpful, though? If somebody's feeling anxious, isn't my job as a pastor, as a leader, to relieve them? Like, why isn't that sort of cruel to let them suffer in anxiety? So say more about that. Like, why? How is that helpful to let people stay in their anxiety?
I think a leader has to get really clear for our own soul health, actually. When is God calling me to carry a burden? Hmm. And when is God calling me to walk alongside someone? And they're not the same thing. Hmm. And most faith leaders, we rush in. We will build a hill so we can go die on it for something. It really is. Right?
That's great.
There's this kind of sickness in us. That we, and I think you identified it, Ben, when you, like, when I first heard you talking about correcting someone, I thought you were coming from a top-down place, but you're actually communicating, I'm genuinely trying to be helpful to this person.
Yeah, I'm not trying to control their life. I'm just like, oh, wait, this is, there's a better way to see this. Yeah.
But therapists, you know, the most effective therapists do very, very little teaching and pushing on people.
Yeah.
That the most skilled therapists have this incredible ability, and I happen to know because I'm married to one. My wife's a therapist.
Okay.
And their ability to help you self-learn is phenomenal. So I'm not saying, again, broad brush statements. I've always said a million times, broad brush statements are always wrong. No, yeah. But I think we have to be careful with broad brush statements. So yes, there is occasionally a time where stepping in and being helpful, relieving. Yeah. I'm more interested in the lemming approach that leaders have, the moth to a flame approach. Mm. Somebody is in need. It's like a moth to a flame. Yeah. I am the solution. God has 7,000 prophets who haven't knelt to Baal in 1 Kings 18. When Elijah feels like he's the only one,
right,
and God's saying, oh, I've got this whole other group of people that are, you know, can do this thing.
Yeah,
I do think one of the things that anxiety does for people is it makes us believe the lie that it's all on us. It's all on me. Mm. And it's not.
Yeah. I think that's great, because I think that's the key. Like, part of what I'm learning is there's no way for me to discern when to carry a burden and when to walk alongside unless I deal with that anxiety. So for me, it's not like, oh, it's always wrong for me to step in and correct or to step in and speak. It's not always wrong, but unless I deal with the fact that, like, I feel anxiety like I'm supposed to or I need to or it's all up to me, until I deal with that, I'm not going to actually know what's up to me.
Yeah.
You know, like where my real responsibilities lie.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's the unexamined, it's the assumed part that gets us in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you talk in your book, Steve, a little bit, and I'd love to hear you kind of unpack this for us about how self-awareness is sort of the bedrock, crucial first. Yeah. If we are not self-aware and able to engage with these things, we're kind of, it's over before it starts, but how inadequate self-awareness is.
Yes, that's right.
So will you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I think self-awareness is massively overrated. Because, and I think what I'm saying is self-awareness is the beginning of a very long journey. Mm. But I know so many people who are self-aware and they have not changed at all. So they almost, and let's take the Enneagram. The Enneagram, I think, is a wonderful tool. I've greatly benefited from it. My problem isn't with the Enneagram. It's with any tool where it's a powerful tool in the hands of people who haven't had much experience with it.
Yeah.
A lot of people are hiding behind the Enneagram to not transform, to not be transformed.
Ironically, yeah.
And the way you can hear it is they'll say, well, here's how it is and there's nothing like, here's just how I am.
Yeah.
I think the most extreme version of self-awareness is someone who says, well, this is just the way I am and you have to deal with it.
Yeah.
And I always hear that and I think, you arrogant bastard. Like, I really don't have to deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have to put up with your crap anymore. And why don't you go to the next step and actually give that thing to God and see what God has to do. So yeah, in the book I have a whole thing, and that's where I wrote that theology of anxiety about the power of dying to self. And I think that that's where self-awareness, the next step is now death.
Yeah.
Right. It's not self-awareness and then you cling to it as though it is
justification, something
to be grasped, if you will. Yeah. Or like this is what I need now, you know, to be happy. But that you become aware of it so that you can more clearly let it go. Well, I see what I need to let go of now. Yeah.
And I think Matt's example of autonomy is a great example because I think it is important for people to know what they need. And it's equally important to realize I don't actually need it as much as I think. Like my schedule right now is fairly packed and I also need a lot of downtime. In fact, the longer I'm a lead pastor, the more downtime I need. But I still want it more than I actually need it. You know, like I'm looking for more downtime than my body actually needs. And it's more, there's a fine line between what do I need and what am I avoiding?
Yeah. And so this is part of discernment here. And that's one of the things I'm curious about as I read the book, Steve. How does, let's say one is self-aware and one wants to become self-aware, not to justify self, but to die to self. And then and then to walk out sort of a good news or a gospel way of living in relationship to that anxiety, right? In relationship to the lie. You talk about the stories or scripts we believe. How does somebody do that by themselves?
Yeah, it is a long journey, and I don't think we do it alone. I do think we do it in community. So my book was written out of a seminar that I've been teaching for 8 years now, and it's an eight-month seminar. We meet every other Tuesday for 2 hours for 8 months. So it's a long journey.
Yeah.
And so in the book, you know, I talk about genograms and verbatims, and part of that long journey is we have like 15 students at a time. We put them in groups of five. That means for every time we meet, one person's going to present a genogram. That's five sessions. So we have this long, slow community journey of transformation. Mm-hmm. And one of my greatest fears in writing the book is that people would read a book and then be done. Mm. But the weakness of a book is it internalizes. But this material, and I would say the same about a powerful tool like an Enneagram, this material only works when you externalize.
Yes.
You need to sit down with a group of people you trust and feel safe with, and you need to say, oh, the guy wrote about a double bind. Can we talk about what a double bind is? And here's one I think I was in. And then you actually start to take it in. So I do think that's essential. But the next step, once you've started to identify, I think you can simply, you know, I say in the book, you first start physiologically. If you can start to detect where anxiety begins in your body, and it's always a spinning mind, a racing heart, or a tightening gut. Those are the three places anxiety first shows up. So that is step one. So what would it be for you guys? If anxiety always begins in a spinning mind, a racing heart, or a tightening gut, where would it start for you guys?
Tightening gut.
Yeah?
Yeah. That's where it starts for me.
Mine's a spinning mind. And and a clenched jaw. I feel it in my jaw.
Yeah.
Like,
okay.
I clench my teeth.
Mm-hmm.
I find myself just
Yeah.
So most people don't know they're anxious until they're way far down the anxiety trail.
Mm-hmm.
And anxiety is a spiritual force. It actually gets a hold of you and takes over.
Mm. Yes.
You know, like, and so we think anxiety is something we have, but actually anxiety is something that has us.
Yeah.
And so this whole book is simply the flipping of the power dynamic. And that's why I called it managing it, because the whole journey is going from being managed by it to managing it.
Yeah.
I do have to give a quick disclaimer because there's always people who say, well, I'm not someone who worries much and I'm not afraid, so I'm not anxious.
Yeah, right.
But in systems theory, anxiety is any number of responses. So the need to have the last word is always an anxious response. Mansplaining is always an anxious response. I just did a seminar, a room full of men, one woman, and there were two guys in the room who'd never heard of mansplaining. It was such a fun moment. And I asked Liz, I said, would you tell us what mansplaining is? And she told us, and then I told them what it really was. Just as a joke.
That's true.
And I interrupted Liz and I said, now what Liz actually means is, and you know, of course that's mansplaining. That's always an anxious response. Sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes laying on a couch and binging Netflix is actually an anxious response, just numbing out. So I fear I've lost the question at this point, where we're going with this. Well, you start physiologically. And
You start physiologically and notice things from there.
How you notice it.
Yeah.
And then can we back up, though, and just define, like how are you using the word anxiety? It's doing a lot of work in your book. And I think you just referenced the fact that a lot of people I don't worry about things. I'm easygoing, so I don't have anxiety. Right.
Yeah.
But you're talking about anxiety as a larger or deeper category than that. So could you explicate that a bit?
Yeah. Yeah. So anxiety is any reaction that happens next after you don't get what you think you need that you don't really need. So Matt, I'll pick on you with your permission.
Yeah.
You need autonomy. That's true. But what the lie is that you possibly believe, I can't say you believe this, but I'll suggest it and see what you think. The lie is, I always need autonomy every time I'm reaching for it.
Yes.
How does that sound?
Yeah. Yeah.
So this puppy shows up and one of the ways you can know what triggers anxiety is when you have a reaction that doesn't fit the problem. Hmm. And again, Matt, I'm pushing ground here on you. So push back on me, but it's very natural, as you stated, for a puppy to need to go outside in the morning and poop, and then you have to go deal with it. But your reaction to that outsized the crime of the dog.
Right.
You may have even fantasized, especially since anxiety is a spinning mind for you, you may have fantasized harming your animal.
Well, let's just hypothetically say that, yes, that's happened.
Yeah.
That's one of the ways you can know. So, you know, what I write about in the book is there are 18 sources of anxiety that are universal to us all. Okay. And then we all, on top of those 18, we all have unique sources of anxiety. So in Matt's case, one of his unique is this need to be autonomous. Mm-hmm. Ben, in your case, one of your unique is the need to correct people, mm-hmm. for example. Mm-hmm. And then something that's universal is if you have values and someone violates your values, and they're almost always unspoken, your reaction to it, the amount of heat you have or frustration, that'll give you a clue. In my case, I highly value being prompt. Mm. I had a meeting yesterday at 8:30 a.m. It turned out it was really at 9 and I was wrong. And I texted the person I was meeting with and I said to them, I'm running 2 minutes late. And that's because I highly value promptness.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, she texted back. She's like, actually, you shouldn't have even left the house yet because we're not meeting for another half an hour. It's quite funny. Yeah. But when somebody is late and they don't call ahead to me or they keep us all waiting, I get unusually upset.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that'd be another clue you could look at.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. So we all have these sources of anxiety, whether or not, you know, we self-identify as an anxious person or somebody who worries a lot. And yeah, I think the part of the key is what you're talking about there. Part of the self-awareness is you recognizing, in your case, Steve, like, oh, when somebody's late, I get agitated about it. I think an unreflective response would be, oh, well, they should stop being late. They should stop being
That's
idiots.
Right.
You know what I mean?
They're like, the problem.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. If the world would just, if everybody would just be on time.
Comport to my values.
Yeah.
Yes.
And maybe that is an important value and maybe you do need to work through some conflict, but the first step is always noticing, oh, lateness causes anxiety for me.
Yeah.
It raises up in me. And this is, you know, this is because of a conflict with my values of promptness.
It's a great example because, yes, you actually might have to talk to the chronically late person and the impact.
Especially if you're their boss and it's affecting the team. And yeah, sure. Yeah.
But it's not about lowering your values. It's about the overreaction.
Yeah.
You know, in Leviticus, it's an eye for an eye, but I want to take their head off, that kind of thing.
Right. Sure. Right. Yeah. So then anxiety is my response to anything that doesn't obey my will be done, my kingdom come.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
So when I don't get what I want, how do I respond to that?
Yeah.
Am I reacting to that or am I actually able to reflectively respond to that?
Yeah. And I think an important part of this that I'm hearing you say, Steve, is again, the book is managing leadership anxiety, not getting rid of it.
That's right. We'll always have it. That's right.
You're always going to have it. So when I don't get what I want, I think sometimes we feel defeated before we even start because we're like, yeah. Oh, I'm doing it again. You know, I'm frustrated yeah. again. Or like,
yeah.
when it's like, I think there has to be the sense of like, that's okay. Like, that's normal. Yeah. You're always going to experience anxiety when somebody violates your values or when you don't get what you want. Like, the key is pausing long enough to recognize, oh, this is happening. What do I do with this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A couple of important points, because some people are also going to be listening to this because I've gotten this pushback a lot. And they say, well, there must be times where anxiety is okay. Hmm. And we're using one word that people have different definitions of. In family systems theory, there's acute anxiety and chronic anxiety.
Okay.
And we're only talking about chronic anxiety. Acute anxiety is when there is an actual threat and you actually are in danger, like your kid's running out on the street.
Right.
If your child is playing on the street, that's not the time to pause and say, what do I think I need that I don't really
yeah,
need?
Yeah, right, right.
So right. we're only talking about perceived needs and that's how cool. they get a hold of us. And what they do is they then pull us into a life of bad news. But if we can pause, as you guys are saying, and die to them, we can actually live more and truly in the resurrection power of Jesus.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so one of the prayers I pray all the time is, Jesus died, so I don't need this, whatever it is, anymore. Like, I don't need every sermon to be a gold standard sermon anymore.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Whereas
right.
I used to have to have it. Anytime I didn't think the sermon was amazing, I'd be so anxious.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've mentioned really family good. Systems theory a couple times, and I know there's some of us listening who aren't familiar with this, but we've been talking primarily about personal anxiety, mm-hmm. and family yeah. systems theory talks about personal anxiety, but it also helps us understand how anxiety lives in groups of people
yes,
or relationships
yes, yes.
of people. Could you talk about that for a bit and let us know what yes. family system therapy is?
Yes, I could talk about this for hours. I just think I think this is the heart and soul of what can help a leader stay healthy and what can help a team stay healthy. I'm so glad you asked. So yeah, first of all, anxiety is always contagious in a group. So people catch it the way you catch a cold. And when you start to notice it, you can see it spread. And that's what I learned in chaplaincy. I could walk into a room and there's somebody in the hospital bed and there's a family members around them and you can watch it. And then what happens is, because it's contagious, if someone's anxious, they spill their anxiety onto you. You then get anxious and you react and it becomes like a water wheel.
Yeah.
Now, without a non-anxious leader, without a differentiated leader, the most anxious person in the room always has the most power.
Yep.
And especially in a church, because in a yeah. church, we think loving your neighbor, which we call empathy, we don't realize it's actually codependency.
Yes.
And so what happens is whoever's the most angry, needy, chronically needy, like if a life group or a small group leader is listening and they're saying, holy smokes, like it's always Jim. He's always the first to talk. He always hogs the conversation. And then we all give all our attention to Jim and I'm ignoring
right.
Jane or whatever.
Because it feels loving because Jim seems so needy. It seems like the obvious thing to do is to help him and listen to him and encourage him to talk more. Yeah.
Yeah. And so family systems theory has a side of the gospel that I think we don't explore nearly enough as leaders, which is the gospel, like in the Old Testament, sin and sickness, they believed, always infected holy and healthy people. So lepers had to stay away and we had to stay away from so-called sinners. Jesus comes along and he blows that whole system up. And he says, actually, no, I can touch a leper and my health infects his ill health. He gets better and I can hang out with sinners. They get closer to God. Greater is he that is in me than he that is in the world. Family systems theory has that same, even though it's not a Christian theology, it has that same idea where a healthy leader can come into a sick system and slowly infect it with health. And the first step is the most difficult step. A leader has to learn how to pay attention to process more than content or the same as content. So what you do at your next meeting is you pay as much attention to the way people are relating as you are to what's being said.
Yes.
Because the theory is that we listen to content, what's being said, but we subconsciously react to process.
Yes.
So even now, you guys, I bet, like pick a meeting, you already could tell me who's the first person who always speaks,
mm-hmm.
Who never speaks up unless they're called on. And then my favorite question with any group when I coach is, who always has the meeting after the meeting?
And, oh my gosh, yes.
Right,
yes.
And you guys where, already have where they
say,
in your head.
Yeah, what they didn't say in the meeting, you know, for very specific reasons.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, they're indirect communicators or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if a leader can start to notice process, because here's the thing, we already notice process. Family system theory is just helping us learn how to have a conversation about it in a non-threatening way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I read Edwin Friedman's A Failure of Nerve 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yep.
And that book changed my life. Mm-hmm. It's in my top five books ever in terms of impact on my life because I was able to look at my family of origin and I was able to take the labels that we labeled our behaviors and our relationships and say, wait, that's not love.
Mm-hmm.
That's not compassion. There's a different label that fits this better.
Yeah.
And, oh, that changes everything.
Yeah.
That changes the way that I relate to people. And it set me free. And your book, I think, takes... I mean, Friedman's Failure of Nerve is a brilliant book, but it's still, I don't know, pretty high shelf, like reading. It can be. Can be difficult. Yeah. And, Steve, what I loved about your book is you really make this deep content, this really profound content accessible without making it too simplistic.
Yeah. And it's funny. The book is funny.
Yeah, man. It's good.
It's like a... there's something to that. I mean, you talk about in the book, like one of the tools to... Or one of the ways to evaluate how high the anxiety level is in a system is whether or not people can have fun. Measure the playfulness, right?
Yes,
like, can people have fun? Can they play together? And if not, there's usually a very high level of anxiety. And one of the tools you talk about is to introduce playfulness, to introduce absurdity. And that can be a really helpful thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I should credit Friedman. A couple of things is I took that idea of playfulness directly from Friedman. Mm. That is a Friedman concept.
Yeah.
And then absurdity is from a different spin of family systems theory called cybernetics. But the guy that ran all the chaplains at the hospital I worked at studied with Friedman under the founder of Murray Bowen. So he gave us, We kind of made fun of him at the time. I'm grateful for him now, but he had one radio station and it was Radio K Friedman and K Bowen. He just, because he was Bowen's actual disciple and Friedman and he would have lunch together. Yeah. Friedman is a genius. And I would say, Matt, the best book he ever wrote is Friedman's Fables. Yeah. And it's the least known of his books.
I love that book. The first fable in that book about the person who ties a rope around themselves and jumps off a bridge.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Mm.
Yes.
You're right. Friedman's Fables is an amazing book.
Mm. It brings out all his playfulness and it brings out all his genius without, because I feel like Failure of Nerve needed four more edits. He is so wordy.
Generations to Generations needs four more edits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So dense.
Oof. Yeah. He's a genius, but, and I think just because I'm a preacher and I'm a nerd, I just had years of how do I take deep academic concepts that I love and how do I actually audibly in a sermon help people and that was my goal in this book is how do I take a deep concept and make it to where it's so accessible.
It's fantastic. I just say that what you're describing, the process you're describing in your book, is the process we train leaders in, and we use some of the same language, have many of the same influences. It's uncanny, Steve.
Talk about bad news, like that, we talk about that all the time.
We
like
help
the lie
leaders,
we believe about
we help
ourselves
leaders name those things, and then hear actually the good news. So you describe one piece of good news: Jesus died for me, so I don't need blank anymore, right?
Yeah,
and we have a way of hearing good news, hearing the gospel that Jesus is Lord and his lordship looks like this in this discrete area, right?
Yeah.
Because Jesus's lordship comes to us not as a proposition as much as like an invitation to lunch or right? Or or a take up your mat and walk.
Yeah.
So there's these discrete invitations. Anyway, I'm deeply encouraged. How if our listeners want to connect more with you, how would they do that? Where would they go to do that?
Yeah, so I have a website, stevecusswords.com. All my stuff is on that website. I'm on Twitter, and I mostly use Twitter for this material, and then I'm on Facebook and Instagram, but that's kind of a mix of personal and work. And then, my book is wherever you buy books. And I host a podcast, and I have guests on, and we have these conversations. Podcast, same name as the book. Yeah. Right. And then I do some coaching and stuff for people who either one-on-one or with teams. Yeah.
Great. Well, we'll put That's some really links great. In the show notes to that stuff.
For sure.
And thanks for coming on, Steve. Thanks for making the time. Thanks for this book. It's a gift to the church.
Yeah, I'm really glad. Thanks for having me. This was really fun.
Yep.
Yeah, it's good to meet you, Steve, and have a good rest of your day.
Yeah, you guys too.
Peace.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you enjoy learning from this podcast, please be sure to show your support by rating, reviewing, and subscribing on iTunes. Be sure to share with your friends on social media too. And we would love to hear from you, so please email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. You can join our online community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.